A deadline to wed looms, but they could not be any more different. Tinley fears the Lion of the Dark Wood, King Alexius, and he is tormented by her in every waking moment. Can they fight through and cross over to love? I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to a new episode. I've decided to take us on a journey back to the jeweled fantasy of Harlequin Presents with His Majesty's Forbidden Temptation by Maisie Yates. And what a journey it was. This was not actually the novel that I had set up for today's episode. I had picked up the second book from this series, A Bride for the Lost King, not really thinking it much about it. If you've been listening for a while, you'd have heard me talk about the fact that Harlequin novels, and romance novels in general, tend to end up in sequential volumes, following the love and adventures of anyone who makes an appearance in the books. As a result, since each book would follow a different couple, there was no need to read any of the subsequent installments. The best example I feel that we've looked at would be She Dreamed of a Cowboy from Episode 2. The author, Maisie Yates, seems to have several long-running series, and she doesn't seem to fall into any one genre. Indeed, she has been at this for a while, since today's book marks her 100th novel with Harlequin. Quite an impressive feat. So without thinking, I picked up A Bride for the Lost King under the impression that it would be no different from other sequels that I've read. I got 4 pages in and was soundly proven wrong. With great reluctance, I had no choice but to order an emergency ebook edition of His Majesty's Forbidden Temptation so that I could start reading this in time for this episode. Harlequin does not currently carry a paper copy, but I am strange in many ways and I insist on having a paper copy, so I will likely need to look outside of Harlequin's store to go get one. But that's all water under the bridge. Surely now that I have the first book, I'd be in for another fun royal adventure, yes? Well, we'll see about that. Before I get too far ahead of myself, we can get started with the cover. We have a couple sitting on what looks to be a very luxurious and plush bed, with blue velvet upholstery bordered by a golden bed frame. Our lady is leaning into the shirtless chest of a man with dark stubble and black hair, and she is dressed only in a tightly fitted blue silk nightgown, with curly red hair practically spilling over her back. It has that artificial sheen that I've come to expect on the Presents covers, likely a result of massive photoshopping, but it's not as obvious as others that I've seen, and it doesn't overpower the composition. At the top of the illustration, in gold letters, are the words 100th Book Celebration, special for Miss Yates' accomplishment. So what awaits us behind this display of luxury? We begin in Tinley Markham's cottage, as she's listening to the king tell her that she has no other choice but to get married. And we are only on the first page when I get slammed with the reality of what I am about to undertake with an introduction that defies belief. Alexius de Prospero, Lion of the Dark Wood, Hope of the People, King of Leary, looked across from him at the small, plain woman. He was standing, which made her quite literally beneath him. She was sitting in a floral, overstuffed armchair looking frizzy and distressed. In fairness, he had never seen Tinley Markham looking anything other than frizzy. It was hoped on the day when the engagement had first been arranged between her and Alex's younger brother that she would have been tamed into something quite a bit sleeker and more fitting for a princess of Leary. But it was not to be. I try to be objective when it comes to reading these. I know that I'm not exactly the intended audience, and I know that what I find to be romantic and attractive won't always line up with popular media, but this first chapter was alienating. I found myself so at odds with what I was reading that I could not really understand how anyone would find this attractive. To give a quick and dirty explanation of our setup, I will try to be brief. The former king of Leary, Alexius's father, had an advisor who was Tinley's father. Alex had two younger brothers, both now dead, but Tinley had been betrothed to Dionysius when he was 12 and she was 8 in a political match. When Dionysius had died, however, Tinley's future went into limbo, including the fact that she would not be set to inherit anything from her late father's estate if she were to remain unwed by her 23rd birthday. With that deadline looming, Alex had no choice but to honor the wishes of both fathers and step in to try and find Tinley a husband. And after reading all of that, I'm thinking that this world is either a historical or a fantasy setting, because it all feels very old-fashioned and patriarchal. Even the way the characters speak suggests an alternate setting from our own world. But I promise you, as far as I can tell, this is a modern and current setting, with the only fantastical element being, yet again, another fake kingdom. There is one other aspect, but I'll get to that. Anyway, returning to our introductory paragraph, I can't help but feel an abject lack of respect for Tinley from Alexius, or Alex, or whatever he's calling himself. We are already presented visually with the concept that he is above her, better than her, and that any attempt to groom her into an appropriate standard for court life had failed. And Alex felt the pressure of fulfilling promises made. The book goes on about this trial known in the kingdom, where a challenger to the throne could go into the dark wood, and should he emerge, he would be king. People go into the forest, but they don't come out. This was the other reason that I had thought these books were placed in a fantasy setting. So Alex had lost both of his brothers that way, first with Lazarus when they were children, and Dionysius as adults, and he blames himself for both of these deaths. Now he's faced with the new burden of trying to figure out what to do with Tinley. And it looks like he has to start by meeting with her in her cottage, insulting her, and telling her that she has to come back to the palace to sort out her problem. He hates her cat, he hates her ferrets and her hedgehogs, even going so as far to tell her to let the little animals loose in the garden, to let them go. He hates the state of her cottage, every corner filled to the brim with yarn and a slightly messy kitchen since she had just finished baking a pie. When her cat rubs up against him, he calls it a creature. And as a cat-loving knitter who occasionally bakes, I am deeply offended. I'm not even kidding. It's like this guy came for me, personally, and there won't be much that he could do to sway me back into his favor. Also, I think we can all agree that forcing this poor girl to get married by 23 is gross and patriarchal. The book even mentions that he has a deadline marriage for himself, but he can wait until he's 35. He's even picked out a potential match, a woman bred from birth to be a queen. Nice to see women treated like commodities to be traded and used as ornaments. Tinley was no socialite. Despite having been raised in the palace and groomed to be a prince's wife, she was, and I am quoting, unruly. She had also been completely infatuated with Dionysius until his death when she was 18. Unfortunately, the feeling was apparently not mutual, since Dionysius was a known womanizer and a heavy drinker. I don't know what it says about Tinley's judge of character, but it isn't good. And I really have to say that naming the prince who was into wine and women Dionysius is, well, lazy. The astute will already make assumptions on Lazarus based on his name. Spoiler alert, the astute would be correct, considering the second book was based on him. So Alex tells Tinley that she will return to the palace with him, and he threatens force if needed. He insists that she abandon all her animals, like I mentioned, and she tells him where to shove it. Well, I want to tell him where to shove it, but Tinley is firm about keeping her pets. He also asks if she needs all the detritus in her cottage. Yes, detritus. And she's firm on keeping the yarn as well. On and on, the narration talks about Alex's duty as a king, and he sees Tinley as another duty to be upheld, despite how much he might want her. A wealth of memory flashed between them. Every time he'd ever scolded her for breaking that protocol. He could remember clearly the time she had come to with his family on a vacation to the Amalfi Coast, and she's worn some swimming costume that was horrendously inappropriate. One piece, but plunging down to her breastbone, the cut around her legs coming up over her hips. He'd been entranced by her body, and it had angered him. You want to know what makes me angry, King Alex? It's watching you blame your wandering eyes on her instead of controlling yourself and basically slut-shaming this poor girl. It is not her fault that you are lusting after your brother's fiancé. When we meet up with Tinley, now back at the palace, we learn that she has problems of her own, especially surrounding her mother and her mother's disappointment that Tinley hadn't managed to get engaged to the crown prince instead of getting placed with his younger brother. Tinley was 8. I don't think she had anything to do with the match. And she's had to deal with a lot of death. She lost both her father and the king who she loved like family, and then lost Dionysius. To escape her grief, she ran away to America and went to college in Boston. After school, she was offered the head position in a charity back in Leary, and that's what she's been doing until Alex showed up on her doorstep. Now she wanted nothing to do with the palace, and she certainly did not want to get married. She also didn't like any of the trappings that came with being royalty, so she figured that it was all for the better. But the marriage situation was a problem. She didn't really need the money, the palace was sponsoring her, but the inheritance could go a long way for her charity. And Alex had also told her that unless she followed through with the marriage, not only would she not get her inheritance, but the crown would also cease supporting her monetarily. He said it like he wasn't the king who could have easily changed all of these clauses, but whatever. That night, after Tinley had more or less been situated in her new room in the palace, she is summoned to dinner with Alex. She arrives in a lovely dress and modest makeup, and Alex continues to be a disappointment. Calling her an unrecognizable creature, he hates how beautiful she looks, how much skin she's showing, and he hates how it makes him feel. I think what's happening is Tinley is supposed to be so desirable, it's driving him crazy. I mean, what woman wouldn't love a man who is so infatuated by her that it makes him angry? Maybe I'm letting that get away from me. What I'm trying to say is that I'm not a fan of Alex's attempts to both simultaneously drool over and slut-shame Tinley. Not one bit. Her gown was much the same, a daring shade that went off the shoulder and revealed far more creamy skin than he was comfortable seeing on her. He hated it. It was not Tinley, and yet it was. Her voluptuous figure on display, her full lips dewy from some gloss that verged on pornographic. She was a nightmare. Tinley made visually acceptable as if to mock the fact that he found her attractive even when she didn't, and to present to him a vision of her as the sort of sleek trophy he was seeking in a queen. Trophy. He is calling the potential woman who would be the queen of his kingdom a trophy. Like I said before, I really am trying to approach these from objective standpoints, but Gaston over here is not making it easy for me. But while they're at dinner, they do manage to talk to each other. Tinley opens up about never being good enough for her mother, and how she found fulfillment working in her charity, helping young children in impoverished families gain opportunities that would otherwise not be afforded to them. We also learn that Alex has more of his fair share of regret when it comes to his brothers. How he feels that he has to embody the moniker of Lion of the Dark Wood, as pretentious as it sounds. Don't get me wrong, it is a cool nickname, and would fit right at home in a fantasy setting that I talked about, but here in this context, it just makes him sound like an emo edgelord. But really what I'm getting from Alex is that he has to basically block himself from having any kind of emotion that would deviate his attention from being the King of Leary, and that he feels as though he should wear his grief like a lead cloak. He's pretty much the only member of his family left, and he's been left alone to become twisted and snarled like some old tree. At the end of the dinner, he tells Tinley that there will be a ball meant to parade potential suitors for her to meet and mingle with. She makes the Cinderella joke before I get the chance, but she doesn't exactly seem thrilled with the idea. Nonetheless, Alex insists and she leaves the dinner table. He takes a swig of scotch, thinking to himself that the sooner she is married off and handled, the sooner she will be gone and remove the rodents from his palace. How charming. In preparation, Tinley gets dumped into comportment lessons, basically etiquette classes, and as she's balancing a book on her head, we get a lot of internal frustrations about her lot, again thinking about her strenuous relationship with her mother, and considering that the fact that she got any say in who her husband was is a downright luxury. Alex interrupts her lesson, reaffirms that she must put her best foot forward at the ball, and insists that she begin to learn to dance. His hand on her waist had burned, and she'd been able to think of nothing else the whole time he twirled her around the dance floor. She'd been holding her breath, and the relief she'd felt when he released her had been beyond words, because she hated him. Because he hadn't done it for any reason other than because he was Alex, and when it came to duty, he'd do it whether he wanted to or not. For a romance novel, the word hate gets thrown around a lot, doesn't it? I know that this is a trend in the romance genre, the haters to lovers trope, and it's one I really don't understand. It's awful hard to cultivate a loving relationship when you hate how the other person makes you feel, but that's my opinion. Something changes during the dance, however. Tinley has basically chucked off her shoes and undone her hair, and yet Alex hasn't released her or chided her, simply danced with her until the end of the song. When he does release her, he simply tells her to practice in shoes and leaves. In the wake of his departure, Tinley finally understands the burning attraction that she has for Alex and continues the hate fest with some proper self-loathing. The next day, Tinley approaches Alex looking to get more information on the ball and whether or not she'll actually have any choice or agency in her potential match. He insists that she will, but they argue about free will and duty to their families. And finally, Alex is pushed over the edge when she says that he has so much more freedom than she does, how much he doesn't understand her position. "I know all about not having freedom," he said, rage pouring through him. "Do you think that if left at my own devices, I would have chosen to live as I did? Of course not. I was born a man like any other, but I must be a king instead. Do you not think that I would have enjoyed womanizing and drinking as my brother did? Perhaps I would have. But I had to be strong. I had to be a symbol, not a human being, and I continue to act in that way. Do you think that I'm choosing my own wife now for sentimental reasons or even the reason of desire?" He stood and rounded the desk, which he knew was a mistake, even as he did it. He knew it was a mistake. A dark thrill worked its way through his body, for he did not make mistakes, but he made this one, and deliberately, because the word desire arced between them like an electric current, and he could feel it resonating down below his belt, throbbing there. At every opportunity, Alex is shoving down this concept of duty down her throats. He looks at the world like it's a toy that he's not allowed to play with, least of all being unable to succumb to the temptation that is Tinley. And alongside that, it's being driven home constantly at how masculine he is. There isn't a single thing about him that could be seen as anything other than purely male. It's like he's a lion in a concrete cage, desperate to get out and maul the onlookers simply for the pleasure of it. It makes me uncomfortable. He continues to push her about choice, about his family, about his potential boring and lonely future, and insinuating that she has attracted him simply because he is a challenge and a temptation himself, and she runs from the room. We meet up with Tinley as she's standing at the edge of the dark wood, and we are reminded that people who go in don't come out, and Tinley is contemplating going in, if only to get away from Alex. He's followed her outside, though, and grabs her and kisses her. She basically boils in the heat of her own emotions until it's the day before the ball, and she's led underneath the palace to a giant bathhouse. I say house because there are three pools that must be traversed in order. First, a freezing cold pool, then a scalding hot pool, and finally it ends with a Goldilocks temperature pool for the actual use of bathing. The pretense for having her brought here is because monarchs of old would bathe here before a great battle or celebration. It's all a little odd, and I'm not sure what to think of it, especially since Tinley isn't exactly royalty. Stepping outside the story for a moment, I actually quite enjoyed this passage, of Tinley walking through this near-fantastical bathhouse, studded with jewels and gilded floors, moving from pool to pool. She allowed herself some introspection, as well as external self-care, which is always nice to see. Tinley doesn't even have a friend to indulge with gossip, so she needs to keep her own counsel. The final pool was basically a river, and Tinley had to swim around a bend or two until she came to the end. And what might she find at the end except Alex, and I am brought back to Earth. But what follows is an exceptionally steamy, no pun intended, moment, and we get a full taste of an overall theme of the novel, courage, and challenging the lack thereof. Tinley calls it courage when she swims up to Alex, fully intending on taking what she wanted. And then we come across something that I haven't seen mentioned for a very long while in many of these books. Tinley mentally opines on her virginity, how she had gotten all the way through college without ever pulling the trigger. But thankfully, she does not mention this to Alex, and thus he is not given the opportunity to berate her for her lack of experience. But she does wonder if, after all she's been through, that the royal family at least owed her this. Alex, for his part, was apparently not expecting her to show up in the private baths, and before I can waste time thinking about how a well-trained palace staff screwed this up, we can get a glimpse of what Alex sees. She was a witch. There was no other explanation for it. He had been here in the baths, doing his best to scrub her from his skin, doing his best to scrub this unwanted desire from all that he was, and she had appeared, a siren in the water, naked and glistening and far beyond the beauty he had ever allowed himself to imagine she might possess. Her breasts were full and plump, rosy-tipped and delicious. Her waist nipped in gently, then sloped outward, rounding into luxurious hips that would be perfect for a man to hold on to. She was the embodiment of his temptation, of his weakness, and when she took a step toward him, he knew that his fate was sealed. Reading that passage, I am of two minds. First, despite everything, this is a good bit of wordcraft. I can genuinely feel Alex come undone when he sees Tinley in the baths, how much he's struggling to control himself, and his description of Tinley's visage is rather enticing. I'd love to be described as an enchantress, who wouldn't be? I'm also rather annoyed, because like I said, Alex is coming undone and struggling to control himself. It's almost as if he's trying to place his poor control entirely on Tinley's shoulders, and I'm getting tired of it. After a short conversation, in one in which Alex remarks that Tinley is walking into the metaphorical dark wood and equates desire with a ravenous wolf pack found in said wood, they surrender to their temptations. There's a lot of choice vernacular in this sex scene, but I could argue that the entire book is such, as evidenced by the abundance of quotes that I just could not leave out. But to give an example of imagery that was invoked, we have Alex, quote, gorging himself on her as he went down on her, Tinley referring to herself as a knight to slay a dragon rather than be its virgin sacrifice, and thinking that Alex inhabited her soul. For all my gripes so far, this is engaging, and I'm guessing that this is where the author shines. Taken apart from the rest of the story, this scene is superb. It's very poetic sex, perhaps slightly over the top, but still evocative. And then it comes to a screeching halt, as after they are finished, and Tinley tells him that she's glad for the experience before she's married off to a stranger, she goes to her room and calls herself ruined, unmade, and broken, because now she knows what sex with him was like, and thinks that it cannot possibly be better with anyone else, as if she would know. And Alex is getting some strange satisfaction with knowing that he'd been her only lover, because he'd figured it out after they had been done, and that his infamously womanizing brother hadn't touched her. Unlike Tinley's self-immolation, Alex is calling it a revelation and a baptism. It says a lot, I think, on how current cultural attitudes treat sex differently between men and women. So the next day is the ball, of course, and Alex has made up his mind. He escorts Tinley to the ballroom, and as they enter together, he announces her as his future queen. I will note that he did not consult Tinley on this arrangement, but I am sure that was a given. After the ball, Tinley tells Alex that she hadn't had a chance to eat anything, so he takes her to the dining hall and he summons food. Their conversation during dinner swings around to the fact that Alex is incapable of compartmentalizing his emotions with his identity of King of Leary. He's insisting that he must be one thing, the king, and all else is useless. It's insinuating that he's marrying Tinley so that she'll no longer be a forbidden temptation, simply his queen. But now he can indulge himself with her as much as he liked, and Tinley, while still stubborn about bringing out his human side, is completely infatuated with him. Their conversation heats up, to the point where Tinley leaves her seat, straddles Alex in his chair, and they have sex right then and there. Alex is a little rough with her too, gripping her hair to make her look at him. But I am well aware that this is not a deal-breaker as far as sexual desire is concerned. I do feel bad for the staff, though. They have to clean the table later. After they're finished, Alex carries her to the bedroom, and they continue on. The next day, Alex calls on Tinley in her bedroom, where he finds her spending time with her ferret. And I mean that in the most literal way. She has a ferret. She was playing with him. Alex sees said ferret and promptly insults it by calling it a rodent. He mentions the stir that they created with their engagement, including with Tinley's mother, who is then dismissed out of hand other than getting a wedding invitation. A small bit of time passes, wedding preparations were being made, and Alex and Tinley are having a small date of sorts, outside on the palace grounds near the dark wood, and even the cat was included so he could get some exercise. She convinces Alex to have a picnic with her, and he goes off to alert the staff so they can make them food. While he's gone, the cat runs off into the woods before Tinley could put him back into his carrier. She does what any cat mom would do and chases after him. Alex returns, and seeing a lack of either Tinley or her cat, he fears the worst, knowing that awful things happen in those woods, and he goes to look for her. So why wouldn't there be, like, a fancy fence or something around the palace grounds to keep people from wandering into the woods that are known to be infested with hungry wolves? Why did you let her get so close in the first place, Alex? This entire situation could have been completely avoided if anyone involved had an ounce of sense, but it serves only one purpose, which we will get to. Alex manages to find her and the cat and escorts them back to safer ground and outright tells her that she's confined to the palace for a while. Like he's grounding a rebellious teenager and not treating her like an adult who understandably went looking for her lost cat. It's a chilly few days, and only 2 days until the wedding, and Alex hasn't been visiting Tinley's room, and when they do see each other, he's pretty cold. Tinley is fed up and decides to bridge the rift that's grown between them. She goes to his room, apologizes for scaring him, but firmly reminds him that she would have gone after her cat even if he had been standing there. A metaphor, stating that he cannot control her the way she has been controlled her whole life. To top it all off, she tells him that she loves him, and he scoffs at the idea, more like denies it. Throughout the whole story, they keep talking about Alex's brothers, how he lost both of them to the woods. They touch on the topic again here, and Alex tells her that he was glad the Dionysius had gone into the woods, because he had desired Tinley even then, and was eager to show her how inadequate her fiancé was. He continually wraps himself in this cloak of kingship and duty, as if he's resisting the monster that he thinks he is. Basically, he's tying himself to the pyre to become a martyr, and Tinley is the only witness to his destruction. He demands that she proves her love, to submit herself before him. It's been pretty vanilla around our podcast, but this book is the most, let's say, submissive curious that we've read so far. It is by no means hard BDSM, but there are themes of master and submissive sprinkled into the sex scenes, even if there are no collars involved. Here is probably the best example. Tinley gets on her knees, challenging him with calling it her choice, so does that make it a true degradation? Again, there is nothing here that would be formally classified as domination and submission, but the scene between Alex and Tinley very much models a dance between a dom and a sub. And the spice continues when Alex takes her from behind and is not gentle about it. He pretty much tells her that she's tempted the beast, as he calls it, so she gets the beast. After it's over, she tells him she loves him, and it pushes him just a hair too far. Declaring that he is unlovable, he denies her love for him and calls off the wedding. The whole point of Tinley running off into the dark wood to chase her cat was to push us to this moment, the third act separation. He promises that she won't be left completely in the cold, but they are through as a couple. To Tinley's credit, she understands herself well enough that she has no regrets of the situation. Her heart's been broken, but she's stronger for having been with Alex in the palace. After Tinley leaves the palace, Alex goes over in his mind everything that had led him to this moment. The death of his brother Lazarus, his mother's failure to express any love for him, and the time spent with Tinley. He looks out on the palace grounds and feels the dark wood calling to him. So he goes, and there he finds a familiar stranger. Lazarus had not died after all. He had apparently been kidnapped, not eaten by wolves, and had been hiding out with a small micronation living inside the woods. He has also been plotting to steal Tinley away from Alex as a way of revenge against the whole of Leary itself. He was the one who lured out the cat and had waited to grab Tinley, but he hadn't. He saw that Tinley was an innocent bystander, and he could tell by the way she looked at Alex that she truly loved him. He tells Alex that there's a lot he doesn't know about the kingdom and about their royal family. He also reveals that when Dionysius had gone into the woods drunk, he had done it with a woman on his arm who had actually lured him out into the woods to be killed. But seeing Tinley's love for Alex had softened Lazarus, and he's willing to let Alex go back to her. For some incredible reason, Alex finally gets it into his head that he's been emotionally constipated for years, but it took Lazarus literally coming back from the dead to make it happen. It wasn't the woman who's been in love with him, who he was about to marry. It wasn't the time that separated Alex from his tragedies. It wasn't any introspection on his part. No, it's a deus ex machina worthy of the soapiest of operas that gets his head straight. He goes to Tinley, who's gone back to her cottage after staying a stint with her mother, a stint that basically amounted to some verbal abuse concerning the fact that she had managed to lose the chance to become queen, but Tinley was not bothered by it. Seeing Alex at her cottage is a shock, but she lets him in all the same. He has an emotional uncorking, admitting that he was an idiot and that she was right all along, and he'd brought the vicar with him so they could be married immediately. She accepts, and we move into the epilogue, which is as short as I expect for these romance novels. Mostly it features the formal wedding for the nation, but mostly it waxes poetic on love overcoming any and all obstacles. With the end of His Majesty's Forbidden Temptation, my thoughts are very much all over the place. There were things that I liked and things that, well, it's no secret that I was not a fan of Alex. The moment he walked onto the page, insulting Tinley's cat and general state of being, there was not much that he could do to get back into my good graces. The story spent so much time talking about his brooding nature while also screaming at us about how masculine he was. I'm not going to say that he was toxic in his masculinity, but the book wanted you to know he was a man. But wait, to hear him explain it, he was not a man. He was a king, the Lion of the Dark Wood, anything but a regular man. Oh, he spent a lot of time on that. Age him down a few years, and you'd lose him among the rest of the high school emo brooders. And if I thought the names were on the nose with A Fireman's Ultimate Duty in the last episode, the names given to the royal brothers were absolutely ridiculous. Lazarus is already over the top, but I can imagine anyone, even a queen, looking at the baby and thinking, Dionysius is an excellent name. Alexius is the only one that's remotely sensible, and that's only because he could get away with being called Alex. But I did appreciate the themes acknowledged in the novel. Courage, self-forgiveness, learning to rely on others. They're not bad messages, but the execution's a little off. Metaphors had the absolute run of the place, another reason why I thought it had a fairy tale feel. The wood was constantly referenced as it related to Alex's darkness, and used as a thing to be challenged when Tinley needed strength to stand up to the emo nonsense that was King Alex. I'm not opposed to metaphors, but they did get a little out of hand in some spots. The novel was, in some ways, a battle between the external and internal conflicts. There wasn't much in the way of any external roadblocks to a couple getting together. Tinley had her moments when she demonstrated that she didn't consider herself royal marriage material, but it never really got in the way of their relationship, as another royal romance might examine. Status wasn't a problem, it was only the storm that Alex kept brewing in his thoughts that prevented any real advancement in their relationship. There were some good moments in this book, but metaphors and self-loathing got in my way more often than I would have liked. So with all that in mind, let's look at Heather's final score. Our cover will get a 4 out of 5. It's done nicely enough, and I don't really have any solid complaints, except that it has that plastic look that I mentioned at the beginning, and it's not hard to see where the photoshopping took place. I realize the Presents covers aren't meant to be realistic like some of the other imprints, but they would be well served by some polishing. Drama is going to be a 3 out of 5. The novel swung wildly between typical romantic angst and complete melodrama. Both of our leads had serious issues with their mother figures, and any drama that they had for themselves spun pretty much from that pinpoint. When we add in a brother back from the dead, we've entered soap opera territory, which is fine, except we aren't watching a soap opera. We are reading a romance novel. And speaking of romance, that will get a flat 1 out of 5. Putting aside the fact that Alex managed to get me to hate him on sight, I didn't really feel any romantic chemistry from our leads. Alex saw and described Tinley as a duty, constantly, and a temptation. And the only way that he could absolve himself of the sin of being with a woman, heaven forbid, was to marry her. I don't think I'd feel like a cherished wife if I were in Tinley's shoes. And when poor Tinley admitted to loving the man she was about to marry, he shoves her away, sinking into a trench of his own self-loathing. And the thing that brought them back together wasn't anything either one of them did. It took really Lazarus rising from the grave. With our new category, spice level, that's going to be a 4 out of 5. I won't lie, the sex was well written, and it's exactly what I would expect to find when picking up a Harlequin romance novel. Not only that, but it blurred the lines of what many folks might consider vanilla. For readers who might be curious about domination, be it demanding a woman get on her knees or gripping her hair during sex, this might be a good one to dip one's toes to get a taste. And the entire bathhouse scene was a shining jewel in a damp cave of depression. Finally, for realism, that's getting a 1 out of 5. I mean, we've already talked about Lazarus and how nonsensical his appearance was, but everything else was a little bonkers as well. I felt as though the author was playing with blurring the lines of fantasy and reality. However, the moments with reality were painfully obvious. The entire story could have lived in an intangible time, and I would have bought that this was either a rustic kingdom or something from the past. But when we get mentions of Wi-Fi, Boston, and other modern touchstones, it ruins the illusion. Some of the plot points, such as needing to get married by a dreadfully young age before gaining an inheritance, would have made better sense in a historically suggestive setting instead of something that could have taken place yesterday. So, in all, the elements that make up this novel are somewhat imbalanced. There were parts that I enjoyed, parts that I couldn't stand, and together they made up for something that I'm really not sure about. I'll admit, in those first few pages, I was ready to stick this one on the shelf of shame purely for the cat-hating king, but that would ignore the aspects that I did enjoy. For my final score, His Majesty's Forbidden Temptation gets 3 Twisted Forest Metaphors out of 5. Thank you again for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or you want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Hin Cho. And Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that is what you love.